Shrink Wrap Radio number 459, Reaching Through the Resistance in Psychotherapy, with Dr. Alan Abbas.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Canadian psychiatrist and professor Dr. Alan Abbas about his pioneering work on intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy and his 2015 book about that approach. For more information about Dr. Abbas, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is audible.com. who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Alan Abbas, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on the show, and you're in good company, in as much as I also interviewed John Fredrickson on effective dynamic therapy techniques on Shrink Wrap Radio number 365, and also Iranian professor Dr. Nima Gorbani on Shrink Wrap Radio number 429. And all three of you are proponents of ISTDP, or intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy, which is quite a mouthful. I can understand the tendency to want to use the abbreviation or the initials.
Yeah, definitely a long one there.
Yeah. Well, you have written what I think is a groundbreaking book, and which is titled Reaching Through Resistance, Advanced Psychotherapy Techniques. I was also very excited about John Fredrickson's book, so it feels like there's something going on in this movement with some really good books coming out.
Yeah, John's book has been very successful and introducing people to many concepts of dynamic psychotherapy, current varieties of it, and specifically around this treatment approach, which is a broad-focused psychodynamic frame.
Yeah, so, you know, that's kind of set the bar high for you.
Yeah.
And so when I first started taking a look at the book, I thought, oh, boy, you know, John wrote such a good book. Do we need another book here? And clearly we do, and you've met the challenge, I think, in terms of the way that your book is reading, the way that you handle the topics, the level at which it's written, and all of that. Before we get into your book, let's take a step back and let me ask you how you got into psychiatry.
Well, I was actually started off as a family physician, and I kept noticing that there were so many patients coming in with problems and physical problems and that I couldn't do anything with. You know, I couldn't seem to help them. I was trying to teach myself some psychotherapy. And then I found that I could do an additional year of residency training in Montreal at McGill University and also learn a short-term therapy approach, which was actually Davinloo's approach, intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. So I went and did an extra year there to complete a family medicine residency. And my experience there was so striking to me in terms of seeing patient responses that I decided then to go on and do a psychiatry residency. So I actually had exposure to this model. It's now 25 years ago before I even did psychiatry.
And oh, really, my goodness.
Yeah. And I decided on psychiatry really so I could have a basis on which to be able to teach and research and help get this sort of the theoretical concepts into medical education for the benefit of patients coming to medical services as well as psychiatric services.
Now, you mentioned Davinloo, and I know that's a name that keeps occurring when I talk to you guys. And so maybe you can give us a brief overview of the history of ISTDP.
Okay, so Dr. Davalu is one of the pioneers of short-term psychodynamic therapies, along with David Mallon, James Mann, Peter Sifnios, and other colleagues, Dr. Laborski, who developed short-term psychotherapy models to try to have a relatively shorter, more efficient way to provide psychodynamic treatment. Now, this became an issue because treatments were very long and people weren't having access to treatment in the public system. So Davalu was one of those pioneers, and he developed an approach that was he started implementing in Montreal in the public system because there was such long wait lists there. And his approach garnered a lot of interest by others, including David Mallon, who actually abandoned his own approach in the late 70s and started to work with Dr. Davalu and help him to produce some publications and help him to formulate things. And so he, from there, developed approaches to more increasingly complex populations. So it started off that short-term therapies were only for a relatively healthy minority of patients who almost didn't exist in the system. So David Mallon would say that there was only a few percent of the public system who could be treated with his own early approach. Mm-hmm. But Davalu developed an approach to work with people who put all kinds of barriers up and put walls up in treatment, how to work with that group, as well as people who really tend to fragment or fall apart in treatment. So those three broad groups of patients, meaning highly responsive patients, people who put a major wall up, and people who tend to fragment, that makes up about 5 out of 6 psychiatric referred patients in a study that I published in from private practice in psychiatry. So very common population, and the majority of psychiatric patients can benefit from one or other variety of this approach.
Well, that sounds great, and that's one of the things that I like about your book is that it comes across as very practical, very oriented to real-world kinds of situations. Now, years ago, I think many people concluded that Freudian psychotherapy was dead. It seems to me that ISTDP strips down the old Freudian approach, makes it simpler, more efficient, while retaining the strongest core concepts. Do I have that right?
Yeah, the core concepts of unconscious versus conscious. In some patients, the concept of a tendency toward a self-punitive system or a punitive superego, these concepts exist and apply across some patient populations. But conscious and unconscious definitely exists. The other thing we see is slips, like Freudian slips or tells from the unconscious that things are being mobilized. We work with those as well. And it's really, you know, as David Mallon said, you know, Freud discovered the unconscious and Davalu developed a way to work with it actively and mobilize it actively up to the limits of the person's capacity. So it's really accelerating the access points to the unconscious.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Freud's model of the psyche, of the unconscious, has proven to be durable, whereas his approach to psychotherapy has not been as durable or as strong.
Yeah, and there are certain concepts that don't pan out as being so relevant in the research we do. So aspects of sort of the sexualized elements as being a source of psychopathology, that doesn't pan out in the research that we've done with thousands of patients. It's just not there. Mm-hmm. In terms of sexualized attraction to this opposite sex parent. And more the problem is related to the conflict with either parent and the mixed feelings and the tendency to suppress all this pain, rage, and guilt about the rage. That's way more prominent and relevant. And the other aspects we don't see. Sexualized elements are there when it's loaded up with rage. So when there's rage with a sexual component, we'll see that. It's a guilt-inducing factor, but not just like a sexualized feeling with the opposite sex parent. We just don't see that as a factor. So it's one of the differences.
Yeah, fascinating. Fascinating that that's kind of been the finding of research. I know there, over the years, lots of people have been critical of the sexual component of Freud's theorizing. So it's interesting that there's now a body of research that supports that critique. Now, at the same time, short-term approach is quite compatible with cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And we used to think of these two approaches as polar opposites. Now, what's changed?
Well, one thing is that the common factors of psychotherapy include elements of psychodynamic models, really. You could say the lion's share of common factors are psychodynamic models, psychodynamic aspects. So relationship function, emotion activation. So it overrides, subgroups of psychotherapy. So emotional mobilization is going to happen and unconscious mobilization is going to happen when two concerned people get together to do something good and to do something to counter avoidance tendencies and self-destructive tendencies. So you can say then in almost any variety of psychotherapies, the emotions and the unconscious process can get activated in a therapeutic way. Now, one thing is, so in specific with CBT, the intention is desensitization and bringing around cognitive structural changes or changes in cognitive patterns. And these are aspects of the ISTDP framework. We use as much cognitive elements as we need. Behavioral work isn't kind of prescribed per se, but the whole model is based on exposure ultimately. Exposure meaning experiencing of warded off feelings that tend to produce a lot of symptoms, including phobic avoidance and everything else. So there's things that you can see in common. And so under a CBT rubric, emotional mobilization and dynamic processes definitely can happen, even if it's not necessarily the intention of the model. It wouldn't be necessarily one of the goals of the model. But hybrid models are kind of advanced models of CBT derived from more resistant populations look more and more like what we do and what psychodynamic therapy looks like schema-focused therapy as an example. It goes back to past emotions and helps them work through feelings and deal with various defenses. So there's a lot in common there.
That's interesting. I guess I'm rooted in the past. I'm old enough to remember B.F. Skinner, and he denied he didn't want to talk about an unconscious, and really that was all in the black box. But I guess as CBT has evolved, it's really broadened and not been so narrowly couched as that.
That's right. And remember, it's human beings doing this therapies. Models that are more like built on formulas is still applied by humans. And caring humans who want to make an actual connection with their patient are going to end up doing a lot of the things we're doing, either by mistake, on purpose, or, it's going to happen.
Okay. Since the title of your book is Reaching Through Resistance, let's talk about resistance. My sense is that historically, resistance referred very specifically to a defensive avoidance of the analytic task, which was free association. I think the meaning has since broadened. What's resistance in your framework?
So resistance is any kind of obstacle a person puts between caring about themselves and being able to be present with another human being in an open, emotional way. Mm. So psychotherapeutically, that means all the what would be called defenses and tendencies towards self-harming in various ways, tendency toward avoidance of openness and being present, and multiple conscious and unconscious processes that present obstacles to healing. And I'm talking more general healing in terms of medical, physical, if you want to say spiritual, occupational healing. So these obstacles to health present resistances such that you could be, providing a treatment that is otherwise very effective with a person without much of these resistances, they can do fine, but it'll just get killed by all ranges of manner of mechanisms and patterns and habits a person has that they can't even see. So this is resistance, and this is the result. The result is that over half of people in a public system provided first-line psychotherapies like a CBT, and I'm thinking here of the whole data from the United Kingdom, over half will not respond to these treatments. So what's happening there? At least a large portion of that is various resistances and obstacles placed, and that the method may not have it built into itself enough to be able to detect, manage, and manage these mechanisms such that the treatment effects are limited or even have a negative effect.
Seems to me that there were short-term therapy approaches in the past that claimed to eliminate resistance. What are your thoughts about that? I gather you wouldn't agree.
We think about within this frame that the objective is removal of the resistance. It really is. It's removal of resistance and weakening of it in the first meeting, and hopefully an overcoming of the various resistances as much as possible within the first meeting so that we can get a look at what are the unconscious drivers. And that process, is patients have referred to it as unlocking the unconscious, where basically they're able to see what's really been going on all this time. So we do consider that a removal of resistance. I'm not so aware of other models that would describe that they remove resistance, but I mean, I'm sure they've existed in different ways and called different things and probably had various things in common with this framework.
Yeah. Now, your first chapter is titled Attachment, Trauma, Transference, and Countertransference. Again, historically psychoanalytic concepts. Talk about the interplay of these three phenomena in your approach.
So transference is a phenomenon that we all do. You know, we all read the person in the present moment based on our past experiences. We all transfer, in a sense, our previous experience into the present moment. And as long as those aren't a whole load of mixed old feelings that are intense and make us anxious, that's fine. And we use it so that we don't have to rediscover the world every time we meet a new person, for example. We just go on our basis of our previous experience. And so that transference process, and in particular as it relates to attachment. So attachment and attachment trauma refers to breaking of the bonds in early development typically. So it could be from the death of a parent or illness in a parent, mental illness in a parent, parental separation, breakdown of the family. It produces complex feelings that are stuck there, and then they're transferred forward into the therapeutic relationship. And you use the therapeutic relationship to activate these old attachment feelings, and then you can therapeutically access them. Now, the countertransference is when all the same process happens within us, the therapist. So the therapist is there, and his or her old attachment feelings get activated by the new relationship with the patient, resulting in a variety of problems in the therapeutic relationship or a variety of emotions getting triggered, making anxiety in the body, making defenses, making avoidance in the treatment process, and ultimately can make an obstacle to the treatment. Or it can be a therapeutic breakthrough for the therapist. You know, if the therapist can stay there and feel the feelings that are triggered, they just get a bonus of experiencing some feelings and becoming even a more, probably more robust therapist as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we use the attachment relationship. The central component of this treatment is forming a therapeutic attachment, as it is with a variety of other therapy models. Form a therapeutic attachment, meaning without barriers, walls, and distancing defenses. And that stirs all the attachment feelings of the past that are unprocessed feelings, and then you can work together to process those and deal with the defenses that come as a result of it.
As I read your writing, I see that anxiety can be both conscious or either conscious or unconscious. And I guess mostly, you know, when I think of anxiety, I tend to think of the conscious variety that feels so uncomfortable and keeps us sleepless at night and so on. But I guess it's the unconscious that is problematic, even more problematic.
Yeah, this is one of the real advantages of this treatment approach is it's all based on videotape-based research for over thousands of patients. It's all taught through videotape, and it's all supervised through videotape. So all the nonverbal components have been studied over and over again with patients, and there's specific patterns of unconscious anxiety, which are markers of unconscious emotions being triggered. So the first one you mentioned is this, what we call voluntary muscle anxiety or striated muscle anxiety. It's a type of muscle you can move on purpose. that is a very specific neurobiological pathway that starts with the thumbs and goes to hands, down the chest wall, to the abdomen, legs, and feet. And you see a very specific pattern of hand clenching and sighing respirations on the person on video. And this goes with specific patterns of defense and specific capacities. So it's something we study and look for with each patient. That's the first pathway. And then the second one is the smooth muscle anxiety, which is the involuntary muscle in the blood vessels, bowel, airway, bladder. And these muscles can go into acute or chronic spasm, resulting in all these medical specialty common symptom disorders. And that is seen with depression and emotion, and that's seen when the emotions are being repressed or unconsciously shunted into the body. So those are two pathways that are unconscious anxiety. And the third one is cognitive perceptual disruption, where the anxiety interrupts perceptual function or cognitive function. So the person might lose track of their thoughts, lose their memory, dissociate, faint, lose their vision, lose their hearing, become mentally disorganized under the burden of anxiety. And patients with that pattern tend to have projective processes, tend to have what we call primitive defenses with splitting, projective identification. They tend to have very early attachment trauma, disorganized attachments, and they take more time to work with. This is patients with borderline features in terms of Kernberg's criteria, borderline organization, fragile character structure is what we call that group. These are common. This last group, by the way, is about a quarter of psychiatric referred patients to outpatients. And the smooth muscle one is about a third. And the rest are mostly striated muscle anxiety as the primary pathway they have.
Well, I love the way that you, through your research, you've been able to root this in the biology and the neurology, which is a wonderfully integrative development. And I also love the way your book gets down to practicalities right away. Kind of no beating around the bunch, no beating around the bush with tons of theory, just enough to get us going. And then you've got these wonderful brief therapist/patient dialogues showing how to work with the concepts that you're illustrating. And I don't know if any of those dialogues are lodged in your memory or not, but you know, if there's a chance to illustrate anything in that way as we're speaking here, feel free to do so, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. This is actually the historical way that Davinloo has written his articles, and with David Mallon's assistance, have written his articles with use of vignettes. And, you know, in the these would all be illustrated with videotape vignettes in actual training sessions, so you can actually see the video, see the interaction. But the vignettes, you can get a pretty good flavor from the vignettes. I still remember first reading Davinloo's articles, and I mean, I would have a lot of emotions activate just reading the vignettes.
Sure.
So it's certainly one way to learn, and some people do really like to read and reflect rather than watch a video. You know, where you have to keep up with the video.
Yeah.
So that's part of why I went this way,
yeah.
As well as John's book went this way, as well as other colleagues' books have gone that way.
Yeah, that's what influenced me about both John's book and your book, because at the training that I went through a long time ago was very psychodynamic, but also just very, very theoretical. And in a way, I feel like we were sort of cast on our own, adrift, in terms of actual therapeutic practice. And yes, there was supervision, but still there weren't books that you could go to that really broke things down in the very practical way that that your books do. So so that's what gets me excited about this. Now, you talk about guilt as a major resistance, and at first blush, I don't think most people think of guilt in terms of a resistance. How is guilt a resistance?
So guilt, there's different aspects and means of guilt. Like, for example, a person says they're always feeling guilty. As a conscious thing where a person constantly is self-criticizing and putting themselves down. So on a more deep level, though, that's the term for that is the old terminology for that is punitive superego, meaning a system that's based on love, but with love for a person and rage towards the same person, resulting in guilt and a tendency towards self-punishment, self-restriction, avoidance of closeness, and self-harm in various ways. So a guilt-driven system. So that is a major obstacle, you know, in a sense that, you know, a patient sits down with you. Why is it they can't get well, or as soon as they get well, everything goes in reverse and falls apart? And that's a very common phenomenon, is they can't let themselves succeed. They can't let themselves be free of the problem. They're too loaded up with guilt about older age towards loved ones, and they just haven't processed it. So the common finding of the person does well for a little bit, and then they have a huge slamming relapse. And that's one mechanism of that, is just a need to make sure that there isn't success for the therapist and the patient. And this has a big effect on us therapists and doctors, and I'll tell you, physicians, I teach a whole bunch and I treat a whole bunch. And this is a very common issue, is all the feelings it engenders in doctors and also other psychologists and therapists when they see this reversal of benefits. So here, we expect and anticipate that with patients, depending on their category of complexity and resistance. And we work directly to face that before it even comes. So it tends not to come. So we tend not to see these kind of relapse rates and these shocking, you know, falling apart all of a sudden when things get better.
So, I'm not sure I follow how you resist it, how you address it before it even comes up.
You know, so as soon as we sit down with a person, we can tell within a few minutes as to whether there's a likelihood they're going to have this kind of pattern where they keep undoing benefits and treatment. I mean, you look at their history, and they've done that over and over again. They get a bit better, then they get way worse. And we can see by how they relate to us whether they put up obstacles, whether they're aware of those obstacles or not, and how much they tend to put barriers and walls right in the office, in the relationship, right away. So we're trying to form that attachment right away, and we see quickly how the walls and the destructive patterns form. So we're always flushing them out. So they're brought into the office, into the room, so we can address them directly.
How would you address that directly?
Directly would be, do you notice right now what's happening? You know, do you notice right now that you're going detached? And then in a sense that you're putting a major wall up with me. So what are we going to do about that? Mm-hmm. How's that going to impact on what we're doing here today? You see, so that'd be an example of clarification, of an intervention called clarification of the resistance. And there's a certain timing for those kind of interventions, but when it starts to what we call crystallize into the room, in other words, make its way into our relationship with us, we move directly and immediately to start clarifying it, pointing it out, and start turning them against these mechanisms.
Okay, so we're going to come back to some of this a bit further down. One of the things that I really like is the way that you tie the psychological and the somatic together, and you've kind of illustrated that in some of the things that you said earlier. You've got a chapter on the spectrum of suitable patients. And earlier you made it sound like, boy, we can handle, you know, at least three major groups of patients. Does that mean that not all patients are appropriate for the ISTDB approach, though?
For sure not. I mean, there's a portion of patients in each of these categories who aren't going to respond to this treatment effort and also to other treatment efforts probably too. But about 5 out of 6 psychiatric referred patients I found were candidates. Now, who isn't a candidate for this is people with active psychotic disorders, manic disorder, organic brain syndromes of different kinds, active substance dependence. So that the rest of patients, meaning fragile patients, patients with depression and somatic symptoms, and people who put a big major detachment, sort of heavy defense walls, as well as people who are relatively more fortunate and only have some grief to deal with and don't have much defense at all. That set of categories of people are all candidates for what we call a trial therapy. And a trial therapy is really the sine qua non of how to determine appropriateness for the treatment. Is you have an interview, it's a prolonged interview, generally a couple of hours, where you mobilize, you get the understand the problems, and you try to mobilize the unconscious processes, the attachment center, see the anxiety and defense patterns, help them turn against them, see if they can have get access to the underlying feelings, and see how that benefits them, how you and them could work together. So what we found actually in some studies we've done is this one interview brings a significant therapeutic effect. It brings significant symptom reduction and interpersonal improvement with the one interview. So it's like a mini treatment course. For some patients, that's all they need. And then others, it's the beginning of a process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And across the spectrum, the treatment length varies. So some of it's not short-term therapy anymore. This fragile group of patients generally, on the ideal world, would have more than 40 sessions. So that's outside of short-term therapy now. But the average patient in the overall studies I've published is somewhere between 15 and 20 sessions. The personality disorder study that we published averaged 28 sessions.
Okay. So we talked about transference earlier, and that's very important in this approach. In that connection, you talk about the therapeutic alliance as a key component for successful therapy, and you distinguish between a conscious and an unconscious aspect, just as we did with anxiety. Maybe you can expand on that a bit here.
Yeah, the unconscious therapeutic alliance is one of Davalou's major discoveries, and he wrote a chapter about this, and it's almost 30 years ago now, where he was observing that patients were having experiences that were like pseudo-hallucinatory experiences. So, for example, one that I give in my book is we were working together, some complex feelings are stirred up with me. The patient feels a violent anger with an urge to strike me and then feels guilt as if she just struck me, like all these mixed feelings and then sadness, and starts to think, you know, then we wrap up the session. And she goes out to her car, and as going to the parking lot, she, besides the car, she sees an image of her dead mother in a pool of blood out in the parking lot. And this is like she can see this. It's right there. And then all these feelings come about, these mixed feelings with her mother that were triggered in the room with me. So, you know, another example is walking home along the waterway after sessions. The patient looks out there and sees the dead body of the father floating out in the water. And then they walk along more and the dead body's still there following the person.
Wow.
You know, so this imagery is a product of the unconscious therapeutic alliance. So it's really the memory banks cracking open and this material that's unprocessed being laid over the current situation, like in the room with you. So for example, another example is, it's in one of the chapters in the book too, is person comes in with a very positive, warm feeling with me and all this positive feeling with me, a feeling like to embrace me. And then all of a sudden anxiety starts to come up after that attachment moment with me. And then this rage and this physical feeling of rage starts to show up in his body. And he has a feeling in his hands to grab me, to choke me. And as soon as he feels it's in his hands to go toward me to choke me, his hands are on the neck of his sister. You see, from early days and early trauma.
Wow.
So it actually, that's the unconscious therapeutic alliance, you see. It's triggered by a warm feeling with us therapists, and I'll tell you, any therapist who's warm and likes people is going to mobilize this stuff. The question is, what are they going to do therapeutically with it?
Uh-huh.
And this is a source, I'll tell you, many times the patient falls apart and the therapist doesn't know what the hell's happened because there's a warm moment stirring everything up. And I think it's a sad thing that I think a lot of therapists become cold. They become more robotic, detached. You know, they become more reserved. They're afraid to open up that system. And, you know, it's a sad thing to see that happen to colleagues.
Now, you must see that in the videos that you do, right? You see a lot of therapists responding to these classic sorts of situations in the videos.
You mean as a supervisor, for example?
Yeah. Or the training videos, how are those developed? Are those real therapists working with real clients or not?
Yeah. The videos are real videos of actual patients who have been gracious enough and very, you know, we very much appreciate that they allow us to use their videos for learning purposes. And, you know, I mean, just the other day, actually, I got an email from a patient I treated 23 years ago who said he was expressing his appreciation how his life has gone so well and that he thought he probably wouldn't have been alive had we had our sessions back in the in the 90s. And also, he's very happy that the videos would be used for teaching purposes. You know, that just happened out of the blue the other day.
Yeah, that has to be very gratifying.
For sure.
Yeah. Now, you have a chapter on the somatic experience of emotions, what we call feelings. And so, you know, feelings you think of as something that we feel. But talk about that a bit here.
Yeah, I mean, the somatic pathway of emotions, this is something that's kind of eluded psychology, psychiatry, and medicine, is what happens actually in the body when a person feels feelings. You know, if I look even at recent psychology textbooks about, for example, look up the experience of anger, what that feels like in the body, inevitably they're describing a mixed bag of this unconscious anxiety and other things. And usually it's mostly describing unconscious anxiety. So the somatic pathway of emotion, including like anger or rage, is very distinct from anxiety. There isn't anxiety present when a person has a pure experience of those feelings. It's the same with guilt, and it's the same with grief. You know, so, I mean, as therapists, we think the patient's crying that often we think it means a good thing. It may and it may not. I mean, a lot of times patients are anxious and they cry to get rid of the anxiety, and then they feel a little bit of relief temporarily, then they got to cry again every time the anxiety comes. And it gets irritating for the therapist. So the difference between that kind of crying versus actual grief with loss and loss of a bond, or with guilt, with, you know, with guilt, the somatic experience of guilt with the thought content of remorse, and also a loving, warm feeling with an urge to embrace. These are all physiological events. They're normal human events that, because of attachment trauma, the person has trouble to feel them normally, to just to feel them without anxiety overriding it all the time. So that's why, you know, if you look in the books on these, quote, normal sample studies of emotion, it's a mixed bag of anxiety and feelings. So that's made it hard for the field to understand and learn about this. But this is something we emphasize with the videos, and it's in the text there, but it's really more helpful in a way to see videos. But on these experiences, which are very, they're specific, they're transcultural, they're transgender, they're trans, you know, a therapeutic modality. They're specific, you know, they're physiological events.
Yeah, as I've noted already, I love the practicality of your book, and a case in point is your chapter on initiating treatment, and you already started to talk about that at one point. It seems to me that's a major topic that's often left unaddressed for therapists who are just starting out. So what are the key points you think therapists need to keep in mind in that initial session?
Apart from doing the standard things that a professional would do before even starting the session and sort of orienting or whatever they need to do at a professional level, if a person comes in and is signaling unconscious anxiety, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to speak to that process. I'm not going to take history. I'm not going to do anything else but examine what's happening coming in with that unconscious anxiety. I'm going to start a dialogue with the sort of the kid stuck underneath this anxiety, the kid stuck under this defenses for so many years without anyone talking to them. I'm going to start the dialogue as soon as I can.
So you might say, I see you clenching your fist right now. What's going on? Or I see you're tearing up as you introduce yourself.
Yeah, I see you're anxious. What's happening? You know, what feelings are coming up just to walk in the door and us to do something together, to work together with me? What feelings come up that makes your body do that? You see? And they start to respond right away. You know, it's like no one ever asked them that, you know?
Yeah.
Or people are afraid to ask because they're afraid to open the can of worms, or the person pushed them away every time. So they just gave up on asking about it. So the guy's stuck in there all those years like that, you know? And it's sad. I mean, I see patients 60, 70 years old with all these unprocessed emotions, and no one's ever asked them about it, it seems, in life, you know?
So how do you walk the fine line? I know that one of the rules of thumb used to be don't attack the defenses. So at some, you know, how is this different than, quote, attacking the defenses?
Yeah, I mean, the first intervention in the center of this whole approach is, it's what's called pressure. It, you know, the term pressure, is that's the word that's used. But really is it's encouragement to be present with one's emotions and to do something to interrupt defenses. So it's like encouragement of activity is pressure. It activates the emotion system, the attachment system. It activates hope. I mean, I've got these videos of this very depressed, morbidly depressed patients. 10 minutes later of pressure, they're smiling. They have some hope just from pressure to say, what's going on in there? Who are you underneath that? Why is that happening to you? Can we look into that together? You see?
So in other words, you know, pressure at first sounds kind of negative, but no, it's really a commitment on your part to,
yeah, to know the person stuck underneath. This is reaching. Yeah. The reaching through resistance part is pressure. Reaching through to the person stuck beneath all those years.
In other words, the nonverbal communication here is, I'm not going to let this stuff slide.
I'm not going to let them sit there and suffer for another hour without someone saying something about it. Mm-hmm. You see? That's basically it. So now, as far as how you're going to say that and how forceful or strong, it depends on the person's capacity. So when you do this first pressures, you got to see that they have capacity to tolerate the emotions, tolerate the anxiety. And we look at those nonverbal cues of unconscious anxiety. That's the marker that tells us they have capacity or they don't have capacity or they have marginal capacity. And that tells us what we need to do to build capacity or to help them just start to move their defenses aside. Now, so some patients, you do that pressure component and they start to bring the defenses into the room and you help them to see them, which is what's called clarification. You know, you say, do you notice this? Do you notice what you're doing? Do you notice what's happening? And then challenge is when you start to help the person interrupt what they're doing that's hurting themselves. So it's only done after you've clarified it. So, for example, a person goes detached and detached over and over again in the office. And say, again, you notice you're going detached. But what's going to happen if you do that? What's going to happen to our bond and our work here if you put a wall up with me? And then I say, so if you don't go detached, if you don't do that to yourself, you see, that's challenge. So challenge has to be done only when the person understands and when the defenses are within the relationship with me or crystallized, as we call it, in the wall, making a wall with me and them. That's the timing for challenge so that there's no misunderstanding that you're attacking the person. It's only the behaviors. You know, you care so deeply for the person, you're going to help them stop destructive behaviors.
Yes. So we've talked about two techniques here that seem to be very important in this approach, pressure and then clarification and challenge. You have a third one that you write about called head-on collision.
Yeah.
Tell us, again, that doesn't sound so great, but tell us what that is.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, what Davila discovered and we see over and over again is that when a people's defense is very high and they kind of crystallize heavily in the room, at the same time, the unconscious alliance is high and the resistance is very high, and these forces are strongly moving together. That's when he discovered that a very potent intervention really built to turn the tables on the resistance and convert the resistance into alliance. So it just puts a complete block on the resistance, bolsters the alliance, leads directly to direct access to the unconscious or unlocking the unconscious. He found this over and over and over again on with cases. And he called this complex intervention head-on collision. And ultimately what it is a statement of reality. The reality of the limits of the therapist, the potential of the patient, the potential of the treatment process, the hope that the person will do the best for them, the clarifying the limits of what a therapist can do, that we're not all powerful on our own, and undoing of any issues of defiance that are there. So to really boost the person through, to break through their own defenses. So it's a head-on collision with resistance that's just heavily implanted like a wall in the office. So I think these terms, a lot of these came from patients. They describe these things this way. And even pressure, they say pressure, and they say unlocking quite a few. They come up with it on their own, the word unlocking. Something unlocked there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where Davila adapted these terms.
Yeah.
Clarification and challenges in other psychodynamic frames, though.
Are there other techniques in addition to the three that we've just been discussing that characterize the ISTDP approach?
Yeah, see, the people that fall apart or fragment more and can't defend, we need to bolster their capacity. So there's different approaches built into this. That one is called a graded format. And this has some parallels to graded exposure, but it's done in the office where you mobilize feelings and up to the threshold of a capacity the person can tolerate. Then you intellectually recap and reflect upon those what's happening to bring the anxiety down. Then you move it up again, like in a staircase fashion, and you increase capacity over sessions, over sometimes only you need to do that for one or two sessions and sometimes more. Depends on how limited their capacity is. So that works. That's very effective with depression and certain smooth muscle anxiety, like irritable bowel type of patients, and also with fragile patients. Another technique is called multidimensional structural change, which is built to, you know, patients who are severely fragile or with borderline disorder, they don't even have any unconscious anxiety. Everything is split and projected, so they can't even be anxious. So they end up seeing you as a certain way and other people in a certain way. They can't be anxious in their body. So we work to build capacity to see everything, and that causes the beginning of unconscious anxiety in the person. Now, this frame, this treatment frame has a lot in common with models like transference-focused psychotherapy and other models for the trauma patients with dissociation of this capacity-building format. I think a lot of these interventions, including mentalization-based models, they have a lot in common when you actually look at them, look at the interventions and look at what the process is. It's really building self-reflective capacity. Mm-hmm. So you're doing that by mobilizing some process and some of these forces and events, and then observing them after you mobilize them. So it's like, building the intellectual overseeing capacity of split parts and projected processes. So again, the modalities have a lot in common. What we think this frame adds, though, on two other models that do similar things is optimization. So by optimization, I mean we work right up to the threshold of capacity where the person can't tolerate a little bit more. They can only tolerate right up to the limit of capacity, basically, so that if it was any more activated, they would be, you know, disrupted or have symptoms in their body. But if it was any lower down, it's not like enough of an exposure that it's going to be a slower exposure. So there's a sweet spot there. And we have markers, physical cues that we look to tell us that we're in that sweet spot. Mm. And that's going to optimize the speed of capacity building. So this is something, again, it's a detailed study when we do videotape courses. And I provide these in, you know, several per year in Europe and over here. A lot of these are on capacity building.
Yeah. What's an example of a physical cue that would turn you into that?
We want to see that nice striated muscle anxiety with hand clenching and sighing respiration, because that goes with reflective capacity. When a person has anxiety in the muscles, they're at the same time using a self-reflective capacity, or what we call isolation of affect. The other way to say it is when you can help someone isolate affect and see their process, it makes anxiety go into striated muscle. That's a marker of capacity. So when we're doing this graded work, we work up to the level that the person loses tone in their body and can't reflect. Then we back up and intellectualize for a while. Then their tone comes back. Then we go back up again. Okay? Up until then they lose tone. We stop and intellectualize again until they're solid. Then we go back again. See?
Yeah.
It's like a kind of a fancy graded exposure of sorts.
Yeah. I'm struck by the specificity of a sequence like that.
I have whole courses sometimes where the whole emphasis is recognizing when you're above the threshold or below the threshold or at the threshold. And we just go over and over and over it with videos because it's something that for the therapist to really get to be able to recognize when it's above, when it's below, you know, when it's way too low, when it's way too high, you know. It's skill set is really recognizing the patterns.
How long does it take to train therapists?
Well, it's variable. Some people are closer to this already when they come to us. They have good capacity. They have emotional access. Various personal factors have a big bearing. So about a fifth of therapists, they're able to adapt this quite readily. And even within a limited training course, they can apply elements of this. And the average person, it's a couple of years of some sort of supervision format. I mean, there's 3 years of this, of different people use this 3-year model of blocks of training. Here we do weekly supervision. You know, sometimes people come here for periods of time, and we have weekly supervision or over the internet supervision.
When you say here, you're referring
here
to
here in Halifax, where we're at. We sometimes have had people from different parts of the world come and stay with us for a bit. We're really limited in our ability to do that at this point, but it's weekly supervision is probably the best way to go, and that can be on over internet, or that can be in small group format. In with, like, for example, in Sweden, we just completed a 3-year training program there where we met with them in blocks of training. So that training goes with what we call immersion courses. So, like, the 3-day course with just to review tons of video and theory, and see some bit different people's videos. And that's kind of like the theoretical cementing, and then supervision. So it's variable. I mean, to work with fragile patients, again, some people are more adept at that right away. It's more natural to them. And others, it takes certain capacity building and clinical kind of confidence. When I first learned the model, I didn't work with any fragile patients for the first few years. I just wanted to get, you know, comfortable with working with people that had good capacity. So I selected them to do that at first.
Yeah.
And then I gradually built that in when I got more confidence and I had more supervision for some years.
In terms of the training of therapists, do you see gender differences? I'm wondering if women are more naturally suited to this work or not.
Well, you know, there's great women therapists that do this. And, you know, people say, you know, we haven't met in person yet, but I'm 6'9", about 240 pounds. Okay.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, like, you know, I go, people sometimes come right away. Geez, you're big, you know? And people say, wow, you can, maybe that's what happens. You're so big, it stirs up the feelings.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I don't go in there and start intimidating the patient, you know, but I've got colleagues who are 5 foot tall, very thin women who are very effective. And, you know, it has nothing to do with their size or gender. It's all about our attachment drive. I like people. I want to know who's stuck underneath there. They respond to that.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, you know, therapists do well with this. They care a lot and they want to know who's under there. Curious, and caring, and willing to move and willing to point out things and be honest with what we really see is happening, what we feel about what the person's doing. So these are some of the features that help. And, you know, it's variable. It depends on how life is impacted on the therapist. Up to that point.
Yeah. And you're also a psychiatrist, and that sort of makes me wonder, what role do you see medication playing in therapy?
Yeah. You know, if someone is so flat, exhausted, depressed that they can't function, then we'll do whatever they need, including, you know, whatever care they require until they have enough solidness to do a psychotherapeutic approach. Now, we've applied this approach on inpatients here in our university department with people who are, you know, severely impaired psychiatric inpatients. And we found a very positive effects of capacity building, very good outcomes, and a reduction in electroconvulsive therapy on that ward. Of a 65% drop in the use of electroconvulsive therapy on that ward. In other words, it appears to help reduce the need for ECT, and in certain cases, it absolutely did. And in some cases, we treated people who failed to respond to ECT, and then they had a successful outcome after failing ECT. So, you know, it's fairly obvious that talking therapies of different varieties, and I mean, something, a robust framework that can work with these fragile patients should be tried before we do ECT. If you ask me, in the ideal world, treatments like this should get offered before medications, which can become forever medications. And who pays for it? And who deals with the side effects, including the sexual side effects? And, you know, this, things are in the wrong order, you know, a lot of times in the public system. We got not enough staff, so everyone gets pills and people don't get talking efforts enough.
Yes.
And then everyone pays for it. You know, society pays, the disability payments, the, you know, the private insurance costs go up, and then the government doesn't have money to provide health care because of all the somatic problems and depression and everything people are suffering from. You know, there's a role for medications.
Yeah.
And some patients combine medication has a better effect than without medications. We sometimes will start a medication, but it's after a talking therapy effort or in combination at the very least.
Uh-huh.
But the majority of cases, we stop psychiatric medications. So it can be effective where medications and supportive treatments and such have not been effective. I mean, there's 10 studies showing this approach can be effective with treatment-resistant patients. I'm talking to people that have failed everything. We've seen good effects, and they persist in follow-up as well. So one study is a 10-year follow-up study of people who are not responding to anything done in the Netherlands. So it's worth putting some funds into these kind of services, especially where they're short and with all the cost-effectiveness data that exists now.
Well, your approach sounds so effective that I'm sure there are some listeners who are therapists or therapists in training who would like to get some training in this approach. How would they go about finding out about that?
In different countries, there are groups of people who provide training. So I've been privileged to train people who are now trainers and have their own core training groups and such in different countries. A lot of countries have a society or an association. For example, ISTDP Norway, as an example. Mm-hmm. And they have links with training, and it's in their native language as well, which is important. In Greece and Italy and Sweden, Denmark, UK, these are some countries. In the U.S., the ISTDP Institute is the best link probably overall. There's a related family of models that are called experiential dynamic therapies, and they're close cousins of this approach. This is one of those approaches, if you like. And that is a central website which has linked training all over the world as well.
What's that website?
IEDTA, I think it's .net or .org, IEDTA, Experiential Dynamic Therapy Association. So
what about the person who's listening and is not looking for training as a therapist but says, boy, these people might really be able to help me?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's some of these sites have therapist lists as well. I've had patients actually find the book helpful as well. Like, I mean, my dad read it and gave me a review of it. He's not a patient. He's a regular guy at 88, and he said, this is really helps me understand how patients work, how people work, and what you're doing.
Yeah.
the book can be helpful. There's other books that are kind of self-help type of variety of books. Ron Fredericks wrote a book called Live Like You Mean It, I think it's called. Uh-huh. And it's kind of a book that helps to understand emotional processes. There's another book by someone named Christian Niebe, N-I-B-E, that's kind of built for the public as well to understand emotional processes as well and this within this type of treatment frame. But for therapists, the local, national websites that exist, the ISTDP Institute webpage has some therapists listed, I believe. It's kind of it's an awful lot of demand for training. I can just tell you that. It's difficult to turn down training when people want it. And I have colleagues between my colleagues and friends and John and for example, there's a lot of time away from home.
Yes.
But we're working to train trainers and who can deliver the approach and deliver supervision.
This sounds like something that you really believe in,
I'm convinced about the healing capacity of the human relationship. I'm convinced that it can be beneficial and help to solve many of the ails that that plague the medical system and the mental health system. Is a reparative human relationship, And I mean, I'm not alone on that. I mean, my psychotherapy colleagues of all varieties are, you know, we're in the same boat on this thing. And, you know, that's why I love having dialogues with my CBT colleagues and some who are like expert researchers and leaders in that field. We have so much in common. And, you know, the big concern in the big picture is how to get resources to patients, how to help them where there's such a dominance of, you know, medical care and there's just lack of psychological resources around the world. So it's kind of a, you know, the cost effectiveness literature is helping a lot. I mean, people are funding positions on the basis of like 15 or so cost studies that exist. And that's in the last chapter of this book as well. I outlined all that evidence.
Well, you know, I think this is a good place for us to wrap it up. You gave a very nice, impassioned presentation there in your last couple of sentences. So I think we'll wrap it up here. And Dr. Alan Abbas, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Great. Well, thanks very much. I'm glad we could meet.
Well, as you heard me say in the interview, I think Dr. Alan Abbas has made an outstanding addition to the psychotherapy literature with his book, Reaching Through Resistance, Advanced Psychotherapy Skills. I know that as a graduate student in clinical psychology, this book would have brought so much clarity into my training. It's very heartening to see how much the field has advanced the past 50 years or so. They used to say, well, psychology/psychotherapy is such a young field, we have to wait until we have more data. Well, I think we do have more data now, a lot more data, and it's making a difference. In terms of the practice of psychotherapy in particular, we're seeing an unfolding synthesis in which the hardened battle lines of old have all but disappeared. This interview suggests an emerging synthesis not only of theory, but also of practice. I really appreciate the specific, practical approach that Dr. Abbas describes both in his book and in this interview. And at the same time, I'm impressed that this is not some quickie fix. For the earnest student of psychotherapy, it's likely to require an additional 3 years of postdoctoral training and supervision. My sense of it, however, is that it would be well worth it. As always, you're encouraged to buy Dr. Alan Abbas's book, Reaching Through Resistance, Advanced Psychotherapy Skills, using the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Jim Wagner in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I am just finishing my degree in marriage and family therapy and am happy to contribute to your podcast. Shrink Wrap Radio has been a huge benefit and continues to be a huge benefit to my education. I'm so grateful for the work you're doing. Please continue to keep it up. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jim Wagner. Here's wishing you all the best in finishing up your marriage and family therapy training. I'm glad that this podcast has helped you to see it through, and I sure hope others will be inspired by your example and follow suit with a regular donation of their own. In fact, I think it's been weeks since even one new donor has signed up. Please, dear listener, won't you help to break this dry spell? Hey, I've got great news that I'm very excited about. You may know that we've had a Shrink Wrap Radio app for some time, but it's always bothered me that you could only get it in a virtual box with a whole bunch of other podcasts. To me, the gold standard has always been to have our own dedicated Shrink Wrap Radio app. But cost-wise, that was beyond us. Well, now, at last, I'm pleased to announce our new app dedicated solely to Shrink Wrap Radio, and it's available for all iOS devices in the iTunes Store and for Android and Windows devices in the Amazon App Store and the Google Play Store. This is the fully modern approach to listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. For a one-time cost of $2.99, you can download the Shrink Wrap Radio app for iPhone, Android, or Windows. Purchasing this app will not only make listening more convenient for you, but will also help to support the show. These apps give you access to the most recent 250 or so episodes, plus the means to communicate directly with me via email, phone message, Twitter, or Facebook. Rather than take up limited memory on your device, the app streams the content to you wirelessly. In addition, it has buttons that let you share episodes with friends, download episodes, and favorite them, and more. If you know you're going to be out of range for streaming, you also have the option of marking one or more episodes for storage on your device. This is the app for you, even if you've previously paid for and downloaded the older Podcast Box. No more having to hunt for Shrink Wrap Radio within Podcast Box, or having to remember the name of Podcast Box. Plus, you have the ability to listen to or download 3 times as many episodes as before. The only thing to remember is Shrink Wrap Radio, which you already know. Every month, we have to pay a fee in order to get this app to you. Out of the $2.99 that you pay for the app, a little less than $2 comes to us, and that goes directly toward the monthly fee we pay to have the app. This is not a moneymaker for me, but hopefully will enhance the listening experience for all of you. So please go to the App Store of your choice or the Apps tab on our site and purchase our new dedicated Shrink Wrap Radio app, and be among the first to leave a rating and a review in the App Store, because currently there are none, which makes me feel very naked indeed. As you know, we have an affiliate relationship with Audible.com, and as a result, I'm able to offer you a free book of your choice to any of you who are not already Audible.com subscribers. I've got a great choice for you today. Psychiatrist David Burns was my guest back on Shrink Wrap Radio number 205 on healing troubled relationships. I was very impressed by him in our interview. Well, he has a book on Audible.com titled Feeling Good Together, and you can get this audiobook for free if you're not already an Audible.com member. Just go to audibletrial.com/shrink. And remember, there are more than 180,000 other titles for you to choose from. And as I've mentioned before, I've been an Audible subscriber since the early days of the company, and I still am, so I'm happy to sponsor them.
Hi, this is Andrea Koch from Berlin, Germany at the IASD Dream Conference. Wake up from your dream with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Andrea from Berlin. Actually, I recorded that some years ago. It just so happens, though, that the IASD Dream Conference is going on right now as I record this in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I chose not to incur the expense of traveling to Virginia this year, but I'm sure the dreamers there are having a stimulating time. Now, let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. I love hearing from our Shrink Wrap Radio community. I'll read just one, and it's from Michael, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, my name is Michael, and I'm a mailman here in beautiful Asheville, North Carolina. I've been listening now for several years as I deliver the mail, and I want to thank you for all your hard work and your generosity to supply such rich knowledge. I am somewhat of a spiritual teacher and a true-born reincarnationist. As I listen to many of your podcasts, I make connections and find it truly affirming. I know it sounds crazy, but I promise you that I'm very level. And I would love to and would be honored to have a conversation someday. By the way, I have finally clicked on the donate button, and I apologize for not doing it sooner. Many blessings, Dr. Dave, and feel free to contact me anytime. Thank you again for all that you do. It is much appreciated. Well, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate your taking time to write and the fact that you are now making a donation, which certainly warms my heart. And, you know, I actually contemplated becoming a mailman myself. And this was right about the time I think I was finishing up my PhD, and I was really tired of the what felt like the unreal life, the cloistered life of a graduate student. And I sort of very idealistically thought it would be better, it would be wonderful to have a job in which I was outside all the time. And so the thought of being a mailman somehow seemed kind of glamorous to me. And to my shock and surprise, I discovered that you have to have a really good memory to be a mailman, or at least you used to in those days. I don't know if that's changed. And they had a test where you had to memorize a whole bunch of addresses. And you know what? I complain about my memory now, but evidently it wasn't all that great back then. So maybe you and I will have that conversation, Michael. And I do again thank you. So I think we'll close with that one. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on my message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Alan Abbas, for his guidance on reaching through the resistance in intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. My next interview will feature return guest, holistic psychiatrist, Dr. Robert Hedaya, who will be speaking about creating health. So please join us then. In the meantime, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.